You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. It's day four with the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we are on location at Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in independent film. On today's show, we're going to be talking with SF Films' Caroline Von Kuhn and Lauren Kushner, as well as the feature film Midnight Family. We've got the director, Luke Lawrenson, and the producer, Kellen Quinn. We have the film Midnight Traveler. Emily Madhuvian and Sue Kim is from that. And we have Jawline from that documentary, Liza Mandeloup. She's the director. And finally, the film Clemency. And we have Chinua Achiuwa, she's a director-writer, and Bronwyn Cornelius, the producer of that, all on today's show. Okay, back on the Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman with my co-hosts, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we've got a bunch of people around our table right here. So
full plate.
So let's have each one of you introduce yourselves, because we've got folks from SF Film. We have our filmmakers from Midnight Family and from Green. So introduce your name and tell us the film that you're here with.
I'm Kellen Quinn. I'm the producer of Midnight Family.
I am Luke Lawrenson, director of Midnight Family.
Suzanne Andrews-Correa, director and writer of Green.
Caroline Von Kuhn, director of artist development at SF Film.
And Lauren Kushner, senior manager at SF Film.
Great. Okay, we've all checked in now. all right, so let's start with Midnight Family, because we've got some fans at this table of this film. Whichever one of you wants to do this, I'd love to have our filmmakers take the first shot at describing your film for our audience.
Midnight Family is about a family in Mexico City that runs a for-profit private ambulance. And they participate in this nighttime underground world of private ambulances that in some neighborhoods of Mexico City do the majority of hospital transports.
It's a fascinating movie here in the mm-hmm. States. You know, mm-hmm. to think that a city of, 25 million has, 45 ambulances servicing them. And so they're basically operating on spec. And how did you discover this? How did you figure this out?
I met them on a street corner near where I was living.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Of course, yeah.
It seems as though they're always hanging out, though. If they're not working, they're just laying on the street corner.
They are. Yeah. They cover the neighborhood that I was living in, and so I would bump into them walking around. I was there with a completely different film idea that I was developing and pretty quickly abandoned that first project and switched to hang out with the Achiuwas.
Well, you know, they're wonderfully charismatic, the family. And so it does go beyond just the basic amazement that this can even exist in the first place. And we have a lot to talk about with our other film and SF Film. But I would love for you to talk about what it was like to be on the calls with them and driving around with them.
It was a lot of things. We would start about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and I would be with them through 6, 7, 8 a.m. and did that for over 80 nights.
Wow. Wow.
So it was a very embedded, emotionally overwhelming experience, but it was also fun, and I saw it as my job to get to know them and spend as much time as possible with them, and slowly layers of their world and layers of their work kind of.
I have to ask both of you, because I love asking documentary filmmakers this. What was your eureka moment? What did it happen as you were shooting? Did it happen in the editing process?
Hour one. where
you go, this is my movie. I've got
yeah,
this.
Yeah, it was
is, this
really quick. I mean, it's this, as you see in the movie, it's so chaotic and energetic and so many emotions flying in front of the camera. It's rare to find a subject that you feel like you can just film without doing interviews, without adding music. It was quick. I was pretty mind blown from hour one.
Just to get into inside baseball a little bit, how big was your crew if you were there for 80 nights?
And it was just me.
It was just you. Congratulations. And you made it all the way to Sundance. Okay, good for you.
With lots of support from wonderful people.
Yeah,
okay,
that's great.
Let's segue to Green, which is an incredibly intense film. But Suzanne, tell us what the story of Green is.
Okay, Green is about two Turkish brothers living in the shadows of New York, you know, in the precariousness of their situation as undocumented people in New York City.
It is intense, mm-hmm. and it's also just heart-wrenching in many ways. And it's a subject that's been touched on by some filmmakers recently, but I thought you did it amazingly. And I would love for you to talk about your approach on the balances, because we're watching guys that are trying to build a life, they're trying to survive, they're trying to do the things that we would want them to do,
right?
And yet, you know, and yet it's not just an uphill climb. It's almost they're doing in spite of anything that they should be able to do. So I'd love for you to talk about your approach to the story and to create that balance so we didn't veer too far on one side or the other on the emotional spectrum.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the process, you know, my entry into this was really just focusing on this relationship between two brothers, because I think it's something that we all relate to. We may not all have siblings, but we all have people that have supported us in our, you know, in our lives, and that we depend on. And so it was really like establishing that as the core, especially as a director who has very little familiarity with Turkey. But I do have some insight into the immigrant experience. My family is from Mexico, and so it, you know, I was able to kind of bring that in and what it felt like to come to a place and not have the support of that, of a community or a family. So for me, it was about just focusing on the relationship between two brothers and how easily, like, one little thing can just tip the balance one way or the other, you know, and how it's things that we take for granted, those of us who have the privilege to live here legally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we have our guest from SF Film. And here's the thing that I never want to assume, that everybody knows who everybody is and what they're doing. So I'd love for the two of you to discuss, what is SF Film?
It's the San Francisco Film Society that produces the San Francisco International Film Festival in its 62nd year this year. And Lauren and I work in the artist development side of things. So we're an organization based in San Francisco that grants over $1 million in grants a year, mainly focused on narrative films that explore issues of social justice. Some titles we had here last year was Sorry to Bother You, Blindspotting, Monsters and Men, We the Animals. And we also have a great history with documentaries, which is how we were able to support Midnight Family. We're based in San Francisco, but most of our grants are open internationally. And kind of our mandate is that the film, whether it's on the documentary side, which is going to be a little bit more artistically driven, we feel like there's great people doing impact work out there, and for San Francisco, we want to keep that kind of feeling of like risk and experimentation that's inherent in the city and has been for decades. And then on the narrative side, it's having these kind of Bay Area values or positive messaging coming out through narrative films. So that's our focus, and Lauren can speak to more.
Yeah, so we were able to support both of these filmmakers, Suzanne for her narrative film, The Huntress, and then Midnight Family when it was in post-production. So it's really great to see, sort of the range of filmmakers and projects that we're able to support through these programs.
Kind of, you're referencing this a little bit ago, but it's really hard to afford to be a filmmaker or an artist of any type. And so our grants are really intended to pay for the time of the artist to really do the work. I think, you know, money dictates the timeline of documentaries. It dictates the timeline of narrative. It dictates so much that if we can be an organization that's bringing in soft money, especially earlier on in the process, we were able to support a post-production grant, but pretty early for Midnight Family, that's kind of the help that we can do as a nonprofit in the indie sphere.
Well, I was really happy to have you both on, because I work with a number of film festivals, and I'm constantly on my horse about offering concrete benefits for filmmakers beyond just screening films. And at the Sound Unseen Festival in Minneapolis, we did a panel, and it was about surviving as a filmmaker, which we never think about. You know, that the fact that, you know, oftentimes, especially documentary filmmakers, you are making a living doing something else while you're making the film. And so I would love for both of you again to talk about, you know, how you're making it easier to offer those concrete benefits, because that's the other thing. The filmmakers find it difficult to go through application processes and even find you. Mm-hmm. And so what you're doing in that regard.
Yeah, that's great. Actually, I like survival better than sustainability, which is a catchword I think we all use a lot, because I think sustainability is almost impossible. So survival is actually a much more afterward choice. Our focus in San Francisco is to be an organization that takes a lot of risks, and we have, you know, a great backdrop of having partnerships with Dolby and Skywalker and all the great kind of post-production places in San Francisco. And then there's just a lot of philanthropy in the city that's very interested in supporting artists at multiple stages, and understands the challenges financially of being a filmmaker, and the fact that when you are you know, working 80 days for free by yourself, that's your full-time job, and yet you're not paying yourself, and you're doing everything on a shoestring. So our grant with Suzanne is for the screenwriting process, to hopefully just afford her the time to be able to work on the writing and develop and actually, execute the artistry that is in her and is her intention. And then for Midnight Family, we were able to come in early with a post-grant and then come back to bring in some more philanthropy from individuals in the Bay Area to help support financially at the end, because it's a journey that doesn't end. So the more that we can be kind of we see ourselves as like glorified middlemen in some way, we constantly think about how expensive all money and opportunities are for filmmakers, whether it's the fact you went to retreat and you didn't get income for a week because you weren't editing for someone else. Like, we always think about the opportunity cost of any opportunity we put forward. So yeah, that's something we want to be very conscientious of, and just really respectful of our filmmakers' time and their intentions.
Oh, that was beautifully said. Thank you. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Yeah, no, on the topic of survival, can we talk a little bit about both of your processes, how long it took from inception to finish, how you made it here today?
Yeah, I met the Ochoa family in December of 2015. Mm-hmm. And have been working very hard since then to get the film done. I've spent about a third of every year working on other projects as a cinematographer and director, and then as much time as I can on this film. So it's definitely a balance between paid work and unpaid work. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. It's striking a balance, and I'm lucky to have a job that I can kind of come and go, a paid job, where I can come and go as I please. I'm a union lighting technician, and so I get to work in the industry, but in another capacity, in a crew physical capacity. And I get to abandon that when I need to write or need to go to, San Francisco for 2 months or, you know. SF Film is incredible, like what they do. And I feel like in the United States, we have this industry that's totally about, you know, what kind of money will this film generate?
Right.
And in other countries, mm-hmm. we view film as art and cultural medium. And so San Francisco Film is one of the few organizations that values film as art and culture. So, mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Yeah, our independent film making and film festival communities, it is an ecosystem. And I used to describe it as a fragile ecosystem. I don't think it's as fragile anymore. And I think it's big. Due in great part to efforts like SF Film that do this, and I'd love for you to talk for our filmmakers to talk about how you actually found out about the grants, and then what part they did play, because obviously they came at different parts of your productions, post versus development. So I would love for both of you to for both productions to talk about that.
I think we found out about SF Film, it wasn't really a matter of finding out. Luke pitched the film at Camden, where Caroline was present for the pitch, and we were sort of immediately in talks about the film from the moment that I joined as a producer, and just remained in touch up to the point that it was time to apply, where we were sort of at the right stage in early post-production to be eligible for that grant.
And how long did that application process take for you? Because we've got other filmmakers listening, guys.
Was not one of the great things that a number of the funding organizations in the documentary world have done is create the core grant application, which allows for a relatively quick compared to how it used to be process. Mm-hmm. So once you've kind of done the core writing, you can use that for other grants. And so I think when it got time to do the SF Film one, we had already applied to Catapult, and we were very well positioned to just share our materials at that point.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And Suzanne?
Yeah, similarly, I actually met Lauren a year ago at the same time at the Sundance Festival because I was a screenwriting fellow. And so I applied, had materials, but I have to say that SF Film's application is one of the easier applications. if you're interested, it's one of the...
That's a good selling point.
Yeah, yeah. just in terms of the materials they require in the first round. But yeah, very easy process. Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Well, you know, I love delivering news that people can actually use for our filmmakers. Mm-hmm. We've had with us from Midnight Family, Luke Lawrenson and Kellen Quinn, from Green, from the short film Green, Suzanne Correa Andrews, and from SF Film, our representatives, Lauren Kushner and Carolyn Van Kuhn. Thank you for being here. You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW. This is John Wildman. I am here with my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And this segment, we're going to be talking about the film Midnight Traveler. We have with us Emily Madavian. I hope I did that right. We were just kidding each other on how I was pronouncing that earlier. She's the writer, editor, and producer of the film. And Sue Kim, who's also a producer on the film. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, we always lead these off with letting our filmmakers introduce our listeners to the film. So, Emily, why don't you tell us about Midnight Traveler?
Okay, so Midnight Traveler is an autobiographical film shot on mobile phones by a family of Afghan filmmakers who are on the run. It takes place on the migrant smuggling route from Central Asia to Europe, and it's directed by Hassan Fazali, and filmed with his wife, Fatima, and their daughters, Nargis and Zahra, who are 5 and 8 at the start of the film and grow up on the road.
Right, and it's important to note that Hassan is filming himself and his family. He is the director, but he's also his own subject.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So it's autobiographical, and it's also made by the whole family. So there's three phones being used to shoot.
I know Angela was excited to talk about this, so she gets the lead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, even as you were describing it, I was getting chills again just from remembering how I felt watching it. It's so powerful. And I love the dichotomy of, so they're on the run. They're trying to find some sort of place where they can land and live. And meanwhile, their kids are still being kids. And that's what I love. Like you see this pain and the struggle, but also one of the daughters is like, look at the water, and is playing in the forest while they're sleeping there and barely have shoes on. And I loved that dichotomy, and it just showed that real humanity in all of it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something we tend to forget, right? Mm-hmm. I think that looking at it from the outside, it's very easy to think you're sympathizing with people, but you're actually dehumanizing them. Mm. And, you know, they're telling their own story. They're shooting their own lives. And the reality is that that's the first time she's ever seen the ocean because she comes from a landlocked country. So she's really excited.
Such a cute scene. Yeah.
Being a kid.
Yeah. No, I forgot. She's like, the water, it looks angry. Like, it looked like it was fighting. The waves were crashing.
And I was just she's the cutest. She's a poet in the making.
She is brilliant. Yes. Yeah. And I'm so excited to see what becomes of her after this. And having parents who are also so artistic and will probably push her towards that.
Yeah.
So throughout the course of this whole process, how often were you communicating with them, or was this just, did you come in contact after the fact, or how did that come about?
Well, I was on from the very beginning. I already knew them before the film started. So we communicated pretty regularly, and I was making sure that the footage was getting handed off to contacts who could get it to me. Mm. So yeah, we're in very regular contact.
Because the two of you made a short film together, correct?
He made a short film that I programmed in a festival.
Oh, okay.
And so, but we were sort of talking about other projects we might do, and then these things started happening in their life, and you know, I said I would support them in documenting it, and then it became much bigger.
So we just started talking about like how to strategize getting the film funding and getting it to the right people who would help. To get the word out there. And I think, like, also, I think the big thing was when we went to Points North, right? When
Yeah, so after BAVAC, we got the Points North Fellowship, which is the pitch. Mm-hmm. And I went, and it was one of those moments that, you know, he couldn't go, just like he couldn't come here. And so we used video from Fazli, from Hassan, we call him Fazli, and I had to pitch the rest of it on stage in person. And we won, and we even got money on the spot, which, you know, sort of...
So nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Very rare.
Did they just Venmo you?
No. Not quite, but it was, I was walking off stage and got called back on.
It was the Ford Foundation, so you don't get Venmos.
But it really, it created a lot of energy for the project. But, you know, but the reality is we needed a very experienced producer, and so Sue was willing to be that person. You know, you don't get, even with a really great film, you don't actually get out into the world and get seen without having that.
Right. Have you actually met them in person, Sue?
I did. So there was a big sort of struggle with us because I didn't feel comfortable, Emily and I did not feel comfortable making this film and putting and like sort of putting it into the world without working with Fosley personally. Mm-hmm. So we made this decision to bring the edit studio to him.
And the sound.
And the sound.
And the composer. Was this, does this mean that they finally have
So our composer, our sound designer, the co-editor that worked with me, they all came to Germany with us to work with him because he couldn't move, so we brought everybody to him.
Okay, so they're in Germany right now.
Yes.
Okay, great.
So no,
I was going to ask that too.
It was quite interesting because how do you say to someone, hey, you know, we're making this film, we don't have a lot of money, but we really want to take you to Germany to like...
So if you can buy a ticket, that'd be real great.
It's like, you know, we'll pay for the travel and we can give you a little bit of money, but like, and like, how much equipment do you need to bring with us? Because, you know, we can't do excess baggage. And
I think that speaks to the power of the film is that people were like, well, I'll do whatever I can to be part of it. It's a passion project, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I was a longtime post-production supervisor, so I knew who would be willing to do such a thing. Mm-hmm. And then our composer came, Gretchen Jude, and our sound designer, editor, sound editor, sound mixer was Dan Timmons. And they just actually hit it off. They never met each other, but they loved each other.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And it worked out really well. And also, like, I think like Fosley was able to sort of wrap his head around like the process it takes to like get a film finished. And he just hadn't had that kind of exposure. And it was really kind of like miraculous that we had this like soundstage and editing.
In an Airbnb random city in Germany.
It's like Germany's like Pittsburgh or something. It's like a dying like industrial center.
And was it one of those weird moments where you've seen footage of him and his family for so long, but he wasn't really real? He wasn't tangible until you saw him in that moment?
No, I think he was always tangible because we were always in touch with him. So it wasn't like...
But I do think for the other members of the team, I think for them it was like, oh, wow, you're real. And then the girls came.
And then the girls came.
And his wife came. And they were like, oh, my goodness, you're real. Why are you so much bigger?
Yeah. And they're old now. Oh, yeah.
You're not supposed to grow up. In my mind, you're still this tall.
Also, it was both of their birthdays the month that we were there.
Yeah. So we got to have a birthday party.
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool. So it was a really special moment, and I'm happy to hear that they're doing well. And
yeah, they're in the middle, or actually in the very beginning of applying for asylum in Germany. So it's still not clear if they're going to get it, if they're going to get to stay. For now, though, they're safe. And now I guess their older daughter is in school, which is fantastic. She ended up being able to not miss a grade, even though she basically missed 3 years of school.
She's a genius.
She's brilliant. Yeah. Like really brilliant.
You can tell.
Person.
Yeah. It's,
yeah.
Now, have the girls seen the film?
Well, you've seen the film, so you can imagine there's some parts that we don't.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking.
So, yeah, I think they've seen pieces, but letting their parents decide when they should see other parts. Because some of the things that happen in the film, even things where they were there, they don't necessarily need to relive that.
They were there, but they weren't really there. Mm-hmm. You know, their reality,
like,
perception
Nargis
of it was...
is there and she says, this is the worst thing that ever, ever, ever happened to me. And you think, well, I don't know if I want to make you watch that over and over again.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I'll let you make up your mind about that.
Yeah, Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, and on that level, when you say, you know, I was home and he would send me footage while he was shooting, like, meaning while he was... in asylum and going from place to place. How was it when you would receive footage and you're like, I have no idea what's going to be on this and what
is happening to them? It was like getting mailed a pile of somebody's dirty laundry, like literally. Yeah. You know, it was just like it was like an unorganized pile of footage.
And it's scary what you'll uncover. You have no idea.
Yeah, and he would tell me certain things, but, you know, I mean, there's just much more than he could tell me about. So it was sort of, there was a lot of discoveries, you know. Oh, wow, there's a great scene in the film where he and his wife have a fight. And, you know, needless to say, he didn't point that out to me as something to look for.
She's fiery. I love her.
Yeah.
Great.
Were there any moments, we have to wrap up really quickly, but were there any moments because of the close relationship and working relationship you had with Vasily where he didn't want to use something?
Not moments where he didn't want to use something. He's very open, actually. And I mean, I think in the film, there's some moments where he shares things that I think it takes a lot of bravery to share. As the editor, I had to do, I think, what a lot of editors do with directors, which was fight him to take things out. Uh-huh. But I won, so okay. Of course. I mean, it's your own life and you're attached. Mm-hmm. And right. I think that's understandable and totally normal. And so that's why you collaborate.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful. Well, the film, again, is Midnight Traveler. We've been talking with Emily Madavian. I've got that right. And Sue Kim. They are the producers, and Emily also the writer and editor on the film. Congratulations, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You
got Sue Kim right.
One out of two ain't bad.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with the Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW. This episode is supported in part by Black Rain, Studio Movie Grill, and Slopestyle Realty.
This segment, we're going to talk about the film Jawline. We have the director, Liza Mandeloup, with us. Liza, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We start this off by letting our director inform our viewers what her film is about.
So the film is about this boy from rural Tennessee who drops out of high school to broadcast his life on social media. And he becomes this positive role model to a lot of bullied teenage girls who feel abandoned by the men in their life. And they fall in love with him. And he gets thrown into this live broadcast ecosystem and sort of struggles to exist in it.
You know, sometimes I will watch a film or something like this, and I will feel so entirely old. And this film is like going, I had no idea this existed. I had no idea any of this was going on.
But it's like any subculture.
Well, yeah, but you know, as I watched it, it reminded me of, you know, of the days of Tiger Beat and Bop and the Big Bopper and mm-hmm. all those things. And I was like fascinated as the film continued, like going, well, now it's like we've reached the point where they don't even have to be singers. They don't even have to be on a TV show. They just have to be.
Right. It's like live with me, you know, live mm-hmm. my life with me. And that's sort of what they're offering. It's not a talent. It's sort of like experience me. And that's the exchange that's happening, which is why I made the film, because I thought that was so bizarre.
Right. 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 And I was also cursing the Kardashians as I was watching it.
Me too.
This is a direct line, from that whole thing, phenomenon.
And Paris Hilton.
To this. And Paris Hilton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. Let's talk about the filmmaking. How did you come upon this topic, mm-hmm. and then how did you decide to make a film about it?
So I knew I wanted to make a film about teenagers around love and like what feeling like you're in love is like for a teenager today, and obviously against the landscape of, you know, the technology as an extension of yourself. So I started doing some research and I found these things called meet and greets where girls mm-hmm. were paying a lot of money to meet and like literally just meet, just hug and look at their online crush. And when we went to a couple meet and greets, they were insane, like completely insane. And they're in the film, some mm-hmm. of the meet yeah. and greets, mm-hmm. but the first time I went to one, I was like, I have to unpack what's happening here. Like, how are these girls freaking out about these mm-hmm. guys? These guys seem like just your regular average teenage boy from, you know, middle America right. or wherever they're from. And I didn't really understand like what the origin was. And so I started looking around, and the first thing I did was I made a short with the fangirls. Mm-hmm. And we followed these three fangirls who are all in love with the same boy, and they go to meet him. And then I, through spending so much time with fangirls, I kind of became obsessed myself with getting access to the boys.
Uh-oh.
I was like, I want to know what these, you know, I became like this weird.
You start chatting with them.
Yeah, where I started following all them and like watching them and being like, what's the, you know, why these. And then through the process of casting, I felt like I was like a fangirl being like, oh, he's, you know, I hope he DMs me back. Like,
well, and that's the thing to me that's so crazy about this whole phenomenon is you say love, right? I'm putting it in quotation. Because obviously as a young kid I had crushes, I had posters up on my wall, but it wasn't to the level where I was chatting with them. And so now these girls are going to grow up with this concept of, oh, I need a perfect guy like so and so, but they're not really in a real relationship with them, so they're going to have this false idea of what the perfect man is.
Exactly.
That's not real.
Or even worse, the more that they become obsessed with the boys that are not in their life, the more they disassociate with their actual
right.
life.
It's right. an escape.
Yeah. So everybody in the film is some sort of escapist. Like the boy that we follow, Austin, he's trying to escape his hometown. Right. Mm-hmm. The girls are trying to escape family troubles, troubles with at school with being bullied. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the whole thing that I think everybody experiences is the more screen time, the more anxiety you get. And I think that this is a world where like screen time takes over. And I think that in the film, there's like a lot of these teens are really anxious and our main character suffers from, you know, anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the sort of the thing that I hope people kind of can understand. That's like what is something that's happening that maybe they, if you're someone who has no idea about this world, it's kind of like the secret lives of teenagers. They're always a little bit mysterious when you're not one of them. And the goal was to sort of be like, well, this is what's happening right now.
Well, let's also talk about another character. I won't say guy that you focus on. And that's our young manager. And was it Lou Pearlman? Is that the name of the guy who's the manager of the Backstreet Boys in Orlando?
Yeah.
Right? So this is
very good,
Lou Pearlman 2.0. And he was cracking me up. I mean, he is a character to the nth degree.
I wasn't laughing.
I was. I found him hilarious.
I think he has some great insight.
Talk about finding him and following him.
Yeah. I mean, well, Michael's someone who's always seeking his own business opportunities.
Right.
So we actually were following, we went to this thing called VidCon, and we were following people, and, you know, he could tell we weren't like teenagers and a more realistic film crew. And he was like, what are you guys doing? And I was like, I explained to him what we were doing, and it was sort of like, I felt like he was pitching himself to me.
Well, yeah.
And I was like, I love this. This is amazing. And then as we got to talking, we always wanted a manager character in the film. It was kind of like, I always saw the film as a triangle where it was like the boy that's trying to get famous, the girls, the chorus of girls, and the manager. And that's the ecosystem if you put it all together. They all feed each other. So we were kind of looking for a manager character at the time, and he just embodied the modern teen. He is a self-starter. He is like, I have everything I need. I'm going to, you know, become my own business. And I just thought he was really forward-thinking, and he is very entertaining as well.
Oh, yeah.
And what did you think about influencers going into this project and now coming out of it?
I didn't realize that there's actually such a whole world of people behind one influencer, that there's a whole plan, like a market for it. And it's very calculated. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when social media first came around, it was a very organic thing, like, you know, sharing pictures of myself and meeting people maybe. And I think that now it's become this business strategy, and there's like so much of it is a market now. And I think I learned that, you know, behind every sort of influencer is a business strategy of sorts. And I think that that's also links back to, I mean, this film is very specifically in the live broadcast world. So it's its own. And when I say subculture, it's very mainstream what we filmed, but it is like this subculture within mainstream culture, if that makes any sense, because mm-hmm. it's very specific to getting famous off of live broadcasting apps, where the emotions are different because you're spending so much time with this person and you expect them to be there all day mm-hmm. and you're living with them. And the slogans behind live broadcasting is like, live with me. And so I think that the emotions that come from that are just very different, and you rely on this person, you depend on this person, you think that person is always going to be there, and you hear the girls say that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also hear the boys say, when I'm not there, I lose followers.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's a very different thing than like if you were to just, you know, make videos or you know, have like sort of like some like model like page on Instagram, or it's the emotions behind it are very different.
All right, I also wanted to talk about really quickly about Austin himself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'll tell you, you know, I'm watching this and I'm not thinking highly of Austin as I'm watching it. When he goes through what is now like a very scripted like wrap up to his broadcast mm-hmm. of like, you know, yeah. don't let people stop you from your dreams and whatever, and
they reach for the
yeah,
stars.
Yeah, yeah, reach for yeah. that
storms don't last forever.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Right? And so, you know, and so frankly, it's like driving me up the wall, that kid.
You didn't like him?
You know, but then, just as you said, you know, when the girls are talking and they're talking about the fact that, you know, these are not the cheerleaders, these are not the beauty queens, mm-hmm. these are not the most popular. And then we're going, you know, he wouldn't be my guy, you know, delivering the message. But if there's, you know, if they're getting something out of this, then maybe I can forgive Austin. Talk about you as you, because you live with it, you know, watching
yeah.
this guy.
I mean, I think that it's just like what these girls want is they're in high school and some middle school, like early high school or middle school, and they just want the boys in their school to give them that sort of nice interaction, complimentary. They want to be told they're beautiful. They want to be asked, what are you doing later? How was your day? Like something as so simple as how was your day is something when you're like a lonely teenage girl that you just like long for someone to ask you. And I think that he embodies that, like, just your regular teenage boy that could be at their high school. And I think that he is doing something that that they really crave. And I think that when he gets thrown into the business side of it, mm-hmm. I don't think he understands like the exploitation part of it. Mm-hmm. I think that he actually was like also lonely. And he mm-hmm. also oh, yeah. wanted to be like, you know, have more friends out of his town and mm-hmm. stuff. So I really felt like his intentions were really genuine. And I think that, you know, the whole world is a little bit like hard to digest.
Yeah.
But I think that he was definitely like a really genuine person within that world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to like.
Well, I have to tell you that the segment where he's reading the contract and reading some of the words, that was just like a golden moment. I think for the film where you go, uh-huh, yes, exactly.
There's it's the real world.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. 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 And I think that that's actually the kind of the hardest part is that these are teens yeah. that are the one guy even says in the film, this is your job. Mm-hmm. You have to go to work every day.
Yeah.
And it's like most teens and also like young teens don't. So they're opting out of school to do this and then being thrown into with all these managers who are just businessmen or and so it's definitely like there's a lot of room for error.
Well, again, the title of the film is Jawline. We've been talking with Liza Mandeloup, the director of the film, and it is an absolutely fascinating look into a world that you're likely have never experienced. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lynn.
Hello.
And Angela Tabora. And this segment, we're going to be talking about the film Clemency. We have with us Chinoye Achukwu, the director-writer of the film, and Bronwyn Cornelius, the producer of the film. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, we like to start off these segments by giving our director of the film the opportunity to introduce our listeners to the film. So describe Clemency for us.
So Clemency is the story of a prison warden's psychological and emotional down spiral as she prepares to execute a man on death row.
Okay.
Wait, a light film.
There we go.
It's very light. Yes. It's happy.
So it's a musical comedy. Okay. Yes. All right. Well, let's start this way. How did you discover Bernadine, and why did you think I need to make a movie about her?
Well, it really started the morning after Troy Davis was executed. Troy Davis was a black man who was executed in September 2011 in Georgia, and hundreds of thousands of people around the world were protesting against his execution, including a group of retired wardens and directors of corrections. And part of their appeal to the governor for clemency was not just on Troy's potential innocence, but it was also speaking to the emotional and psychological consequences killing Troy would have on correction staff. So the morning after he was executed, as I was grappling with my feelings and about his execution, as so many people were, I asked myself, if all of us were kind of navigating these emotional complexities, what must it be like for the people whose livelihoods are tied to the taking of human life? And so that really was the seed that was planted. And I really, 2 years later in 2013, I started a very deep dive into researching this world and capital punishment and the ecosystem of humanities that are connected to capital punishment specifically, but incarceration in general.
And Bronwyn, how did you connect with Chinoya on the film?
We actually were put in touch by a woman by the name of Mimi Plausch at the Chicago International Film Festival, and we had both had features that had played there in the past. And when Chinoya reached out to her looking for a producer for her new project, Clemency, Mimi knew what a supporter of female filmmakers I was and put us in touch. And sent over the script, and that was about 4.5 years ago. And I was in production at the time on something, but the script really stuck with me. And so as soon as I was finished with that, reached out to Chinoya and was like, what's happening with it? And we met, and here we are. It's been an awesome journey.
Just wanted to really quickly go back to the research that you were doing, Chinoya. Can you talk more about that? Was there a lot of research?
Oh, it was a deep, deep, deep dive into a lot. I mean, it started with secondary research, and where I interviewed several of those retired wardens and directors of corrections who had protested against Troy Davis's execution. Mm-hmm. I spoke with several death row lawyers. I visited some prisons and death row facilities. I read every book and article imaginable, but that was just a secondary research. Mm-hmm. The deep dive really came in when I moved to Ohio and volunteered on a clemency case for Tyra Patterson, who was serving a life sentence for crime she did not commit. Tyra got out over a year ago.
Oh, great.
But I worked really closely with her legal team, and I then volunteered on a lot of other clemency cases for about 13 women and talked with a lot, many more wardens and chaplains and lawyers and activists and organizers and all kinds of people in the correction staff. And this was a period of 4 years. As a result of that, I developed a passion for advocating for the humanity of people who are incarcerated. And that led me to create a film program where I taught women who are incarcerated how to make their own short films from script to screen. And so all of that really grounded the film in a level of authenticity and humanity.
Yeah.
I love to ask filmmakers about their moment where they go, oh, this is the movie. This is the movie I was hoping to make, or this is the movie I wasn't expecting to make. And, you know, sometimes it happens in the scripting process, sometimes it happens in the filming process, sometimes during in the editing bay. When was that moment for you for this film?
My this is the moment, this is the film that I really want to make moment. It really came... So I was always really clear about the kind of film I wanted to make from the script stage. And I feel like Brahman and I were very dedicated and focused on that vision. But there was a moment that I remember when we were in a color grading session. And, you know, I've watched the film a billion times by that point. But this was the first time that I really allowed myself to just watch it without taking a copious amount of notes and, you know, being so meticulous about every single angle and everything. And I heard the dialogue for the first time, and I remembered the place I was in when I was writing the dialogue. I remembered the place I was in when I first had the idea for this film. I just remembered the genesis of it, and I'm looking at this film and I'm like, you know what, this is this is the film I wanted to make from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And it was just that first moment I had. I was like, wow, this is it. This is really it.
Very cool. And Bronwyn, being a producer, having the title of producer, can mean a number of different things.
Yes, it can.
different hats.
So I would love for you to talk about, literally, what you did as producer to help make this film become a reality. And then, Chinoya, I want to follow up by having you talk about the assistance that Bronwyn was that doesn't fall into those obvious categories. Mm-hmm. Where she saved your butt making the movie. All right, so Bronwyn, you start.
Okay. Well, definitely, I mean, yes, and there are many different types of producers, and I think that I'm very committed to sort of being a script-to-screen producer and being involved in all aspects of it, because it's very important to me working closely with the director and ensuring that you're working to protect that vision and that we were aligned in that vision of getting it onto the screen. And fortunately, I had a fantastic partner to do that with. So when we started from the script stage, we also developed the script together and really got that to a point. I was involved in the casting and with getting Alfre Woodard attached to the project, and fortunately she committed pretty early on. She was attached for a couple of years because she really believed in the project and has been a wonderful partner on the project as well. And so then also in putting together the initial budgets and schedules and finding locations, because we wanted to shoot in an actual facility, which we were fortunate enough to find one. It was a jail, not a prison, but it at least allowed us the appropriate environment to film in rather than having to build sort of all of, you know, the various sets. And then through the financing and overall packaging and teaming up and then getting a sales agent involved. And of course, before that, we had the whole production and editing and post, and then the sales agent, and then we've been fortunate enough to sort of end up where we are. But it's really an all-encompassing journey, and there are a few producers that do that and sort of all the way through. And it's as I said, fortunately, I had a terrific partner to do that with.
All right, Chinoya, now you're up.
Pressure.
My partnership collaboration with Bronwyn from the moment we first communicated has really been divine. And I mean that in every sense of the word.
Aww.
I mean, we have a really good professional relationship, but what I think really translates in, through the film is we have a really good, like, kind of soulful connection where we really have a lot of the same kind of guttural instincts, the same kind of level of integrity as people, the same kind of commitment to women and telling women's stories. And that she created a safe space for me to be who I am in all of what that means beyond me as a filmmaker and an artist, but as a woman, as a woman of color, as a human being. And so I think you feel that in the film, that I was, this producer, Bronwyn, created a safe space for me and for everybody else on set. And so we were able to do our best work. So I'm really fortunate, really, really fortunate.
All right.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, let
me breathe for 1 minute.
But Chinoya, being a social justice advocate and being so emotionally connected to this subject, how did that emotion and connection affect your filmmaking? Did you have to separate yourself from that at times in order to tell the story in, honestly, or did it charge you forward? And in doing so, how did making this film change any preconceived notions, if it did, or strengthen?
Well, from the writing stage as a writer, I really allow myself to feel deeply for each of the characters. So I remember writing the script to Clemency crying, you know, and I'm really putting myself in the emotional place of all of the characters. I allow myself to go there. Once I'm done with the draft, then I'm really good at emotionally compartmentalizing because, you know, we have work to do. But because I have to make myself so emotionally available when I write, it was challenging at times having to, while we were particularly like in pre-production, having to revise parts of the script, having to rework, because I had to go back to the emotional place to revise or to rewrite or to, you know, and so that was really challenging. I remember there was one day in pre-production, it was pretty close to production. I had to talk with one of the wardens about getting the language right for one of the scenes with the warden, and it happened to be about talking about protocol and how to strap somebody. It was just, it was heavy. And it was a hard conversation because I had to go back to that emotional place to rewrite the dialogue during the height of pre-production when I had all these like logistical things I needed to take care of. And so that was difficult going back and forth. But this process of research that has led me to a deepened sense of social justice advocacy has been transformative. It has expanded my capacity for being able to not write people off and define them by their worst possible acts. It has really expanded my capacity for compassion and justice and mercy, and has really rooted me in all aspects of my life.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, it'll be wonderful to see the reaction the film gets here at Sundance. Again, we've been talking about the film Clemency with Chinoye Chukwu, who is the writer-director of the film, and Bronwyn Cornelius, the producer of the film. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're wrapping up the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Caroline Cromwell of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. This show is audio produced by Charlene Goto with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Tune in tomorrow, which will include interviews with director Alex Lehman from Paddleton, as well as Justin Chan and other folks from Ms. Purple and the environmental documentary Kefaru.